Good morning, everyone. I'm Seth Axelrod. I'm an associate professor in the Yale School of Medicine. I do my clinical work in the Yale New Haven Psychiatric Hospital, where I work and train individuals to treat people struggling with borderline personality disorder. I'm so excited to have each of you here with us today, this morning, to help us better understand borderline personality disorder and its treatments using two empirically supported methods. I'd like to acknowledge and express my appreciation to our program co-sponsors, beginning with Perry Hoffman, James Hall, and Trish Woodward from the Executive Board of the National Education Alliance, Drs. John Crystal and William Sledge of the Yale Department of Psychiatry and Yale New Haven Hospital, as well as Yale New Haven Hospital's Psychiatric Hospital's Vice President Steve Mers, and the Adult IOP Program Manager, Mr. Leonard Hill. I'd like to express strong appreciation to our newest co-sponsors, Silver Hill Hospital, including their medical director, Dr. Sigurd Ackerman, and the Austin Riggs Center, including medical director and CEO Edward Shapiro, and Dr. John Muller, their director of education. There's a very long list of individuals to acknowledge in bringing the conference together, but for now I'd like to acknowledge my program co-directors, Drs. Perry Hoffman, Alan Frazetti, and Anthony Bateman, the program committee, including Drs. Greg McEwen, Emily Ansel, Nicole Kane, and Francesca Paraplechikova. And I'd like to offer a special thanks again to Dr. Lois Troy Kane, who went above and beyond in helping to locate top MBT experts to join us, in addition to Dr. Anthony Bateman. We have a very long list of program volunteers who have provided essential functions for keeping the days going. Finally, I'd like to thank all of our presenters for volunteering their time. As Perry said, no one gets paid for doing this. The only reason that we are able to put on this conference and have such top experts of the world speak to you is out of the goodness of their hearts to help share the message about the work that they do and their understanding of this disorder. One thing that makes NEA BPD conferences so special for me is the gathering together of clinicians, researchers, mental health trainees, alongside individuals who struggle with borderline personality disorder and family members of those individuals. All of us are affected by these struggles, and it takes all of us working together to face these challenges. For those who are more directly affected by borderline personality disorder, I'd like to acknowledge that hearing the presentations and demonstrations today can be an emotionally taxing experience, and I strongly encourage you to make a point of taking care of yourself and seeking support from others as needed. If you should find yourself, becoming distressed today. At the end of the day, we will have individuals available near the registration desk who can help in finding local treatment options, should that be of need. Please do take time to visit each of our conference exhibitors, including we have representatives from several treatment programs specializing in borderline personality disorder, and also the DVD resource. You can meet its developer, Kevin Dawkins. This is what Perry referred to earlier. Also, please take time to visit our bookseller. A portion of the proceeds for those books will go towards supporting these conferences. So please, if you see titles, this would be a great time to pick them up. A few, and there's several books there that are authored by presenters that you'll see today. A few final logistics. Be sure to turn in your CE form at the end of the conference, along with your course evaluation if you are needing continuing education credits. For everyone, please do fill out those evaluation forms. It's very helpful to get that feedback on the conference. Another piece of logistics, if you haven't been to our conferences here before, following each of the presentations, there will be opportunities to share questions. And the way we ask you to do that is to write your questions down on the green index cards that came with your program today. Jot them on, hold them up, or send them to the aisle, and our program volunteers will take the cards, bring them up, and I'll make sure to share them with our presenters as we have time. So please do take advantage of that, and please get more index cards. If you go through yours, we're happy to give you more and have you participate. All right, and I'm going to move on to our first presentation. I essentially want to orient us to what we're going to be hearing about today. And give you something of a crash course in borderline personality disorder that will relate to some of the challenges that we're dealing with. A very brief history. Borderline what is a question that often comes up. What is this? As psychiatric classification developed, patients who did not fit neatly into the psychotic, affective, or schizophrenic can develop psychosis, or neurotic groups, if they didn't fit into these two groups, they were on the borderline. It was kind of they were the people who weren't described well. The label borderline state, this is one early commentary on this, the label borderline state, when used as a diagnosis, conveys more information about the uncertainty and indecision of the psychiatrist than it does about the condition of the patient. That was when the term was really first getting more recognized. That was from the first article that really kind of spelled out, well, what is this thing that people are calling borderline? And even today, unfortunately, borderline sometimes gets thrown around referring to individuals who don't quite fit into the system properly, who don't quite respond in the ways that they're expected to in treatment units. That patient must be borderline. So it's really kind of almost a misfit. Or it can occur that way, which is extremely unfortunate, and I hope I'll make that clear as we go. A study tracing the diagnostic course of individuals diagnosed with borderline concluded that it was an adjective in search of a noun, that it wasn't so clear that this was a single group, that borderline really explained as much as described this kind of large group of individuals struggling from a variety of issues. A brief timeline, just to give a sense, it was in 1975 that we really started, that John Gunderson and Margaret Singer really pulled together what all the research to identify a way of diagnosing, pulling together criteria for figuring out who actually has borderline personality disorder. That was significant in getting us to the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, of 1980, which introduced borderline personality disorder. In close to its modern definition. 91 was when Linehan published the first randomized controlled trial showing that treatment could help individuals with borderline personality disorder, which was largely questioned. 1999 was the second published randomized controlled trial by Anthony Bateman and Peter Fonagy. Anthony Bateman obviously is with us today, that also showed effectiveness. In 2006, 2007, NAMI recognized borderline personality disorder as a major mental illness. That's very recently. Before then, again, borderline often just sort of falls off the map. Perry Hoffman referred to the U.S. House of Reps resolution recognizing borderline personality disorder. 2013, DSM-5 is expected to redefine the BPD diagnosis, and I have a lot of detail of that in my slides. I'll go through that pretty quickly, but it's still a work in progress, and right now it's looking like the diagnosis may be a lot more clear in some ways, but a lot more complicated through the various methods they're using. Generally, if you're new to this idea of personality disorders, Axis 1, Axis 2, just briefly, for many mental health disorders, there is a notion of an individual who had some high level or some level of functioning in the world, and then are kind of struck by some problem that interferes with them, and they can kind of see the problem. They become depressed, or they go through a trauma and they develop PTSD, or even in schizophrenia, there's a talk of kind of a psychotic break, that there was a pre-morbid level of functioning, and then the illness is very clear. And personality disorders, which get diagnosed on Axis 2, there's a term referred to as egosyntonic, something that I recognize as kind of who I am, as opposed to ego dystonic, something that's not quite who I am. Axis 2 of personality disorders, it's really the individual, the way they experience the world, the way they experience themselves and others, the way they act, that's who they are. There isn't some beforehand, I was fine, and now I developed a problem, which makes it quite a bit different. That's a little bit of a simplification, but just to give you a little bit of a sense, this is really something that individuals can often trace into very early in their lives, struggling with emotions and identity and the various issues. In terms of the diagnosis itself, Currently, we're in the DSM-IV text revision is our most current edition of DSM, and it describes personality traits as characteristic ways of thinking, feeling, behaving, and relating to others that are consistent across time and context, different situations, and that extreme or inflexible personality traits that cause significant distress or impairment in social occupational functioning would then be a personality disorder. And I really want to draw attention throughout the talk to this idea of impaired social and occupational functioning. I was really pleased to be reminded by Perry Hoffman of the mission statement of the National Education Alliance to really support the improvement of functioning, of functioning in individuals, as opposed to simply the diagnosis, and I'll refer to that again. Borderline personality disorder, a pervasive pattern of relationship, self-image, and affective instability, emotional instability, that's marked by at least five of this list of symptoms. So many of you are familiar with this. And they often get lumped into different pools, into some of the criteria are more about emotional experience, some are more about experience of oneself and the disturbances there, some are about relationships, and then finally there are symptoms or criteria that refer to impulsive, dangerous behaviors that are characteristic, including suicidality and self-harm. How common is it? Community studies have typically found that it's around 1 to 2% of the population, which would make it a bit more common than schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. However, the most recent large epidemiological study found 5.9% in the community met criteria for borderline personality disorder, which was very striking, and it's really caught a lot of attention that perhaps this was a lot more pervasive than we previously thought. Another thing, in community studies, no gender differences. And further on the slide, it mentions clinical studies, 75% of those diagnosed are women. And it was kind of understood, oh, is this about women? Is this, you know, what is this exactly? But there's actually several community studies at this point that really demonstrate that, no, actually in the community, it strikes equally in men and women. And perhaps there are reasons why we don't pick that up in clinical settings. Perhaps these individuals don't end up in clinical settings, or perhaps we focus on other diagnoses. It's hard to say. How consistent over time? This was originally believed to be a lifelong condition, that if you have borderline personality disorder, that's your life sentence. You will have that disorder. There really is no hope. There are still, unfortunately, many clinicians, administrators, many people out there who believe that this is an untreatable condition, and at best, what you should do if you treat such individuals is support them through their dysfunction and help them accept that that's pretty much what they've got. And it's extremely unfortunate. There are several longitudinal studies. I only list two here, but there are several longitudinal studies that show that this is not the case, that this diagnosis appears to drop off over time. Also, there are many treatments I'll mention that show that this is a highly treatable condition, that this idea that this just has to continue in its most distressed, challenging state is not held up by the literature. This is from the CLIP study, the Collaborative Longitudinal Personality Study, which was a collaboration between Yale and several other institutions, Harvard, Columbia, Brown, and they tracked... they tracked four personality disorder groups, including borderline personality disorder, which is represented in green, and they compared them to major depression controls. And this is showing a diagnostic remission over time. And here we are looking at months. These are assessment periods of how many months. So this goes into 120. That would be 10 years about what's happening. And what you can see is that while major depression has a pretty rapid remission, people don't meet the diagnosis, by the 6-month, the 12-month mark, most of them aren't depressed when they come back in for follow-up assessment. It's much slower with the personality disorders. However, on the other hand, over time, you can see what's happening. These individuals with personality disorders catch up. And 50% would be right here within 2 years, about half of the individuals are no longer meeting criteria for borderline personality disorder. This is a replication of findings that Mary Zanarini has presented here in a previous conference, that this diagnosis drops off over time, and here at 10 years, hardly any of them are still meeting the diagnosis. This is diagnostic relapse. How many individuals have a recurrence of the disorder? They lose it, and then it comes back. And we know this about major depression. That's that line, that if you have a major depressive episode, you're at very high risk. Most individuals will have another major depressive episode, and you can see that right here. But look at the personality disorders. Once the diagnosis leaves, it's much less likely to come back than, say, major depression. And again, the green is borderline personality disorder. It's actually the least, with about 20% over 10 years that fall off criteria and then come back, which is very striking, again, in terms of changes. Now, this one is a bit more concerning. This is a functional remission. This is looking at one's ability to actually function in the world in terms of things like work and relationships. And in terms of a functional remission, we see that major depression, there are high rates of functional remission over time, that individuals who weren't able to work, weren't able to maintain relationships, are able to do so, the majority. Personality disorder is much less, and borderline the least. Now, this is also has been shown by Mary Zanarini's work, and it's often taken to suggest that, that diagnosis we have isn't so important. Fine, you're no longer borderline personality disorder, but you still can't function in the world. You still are hopeless, etc. Now, the thing to pay attention to here is that this is not a treatment study. This is just looking at when you take a large group of people recruited from treatment settings and involved with treatments, that this is what you can expect. Now, what happens, though, if we think about the treatment studies, we have many, many different treatments now demonstrating that if you give a focused treatment addressing the problems of borderline personality disorder in a systematic way, you see much more improvement than a generic therapy. And we can assume that almost all of these individuals were involved in generic studies, maybe going into specialized treatments and coming out of them, but not specifically involved in that kind of study. This is from Anthony Bateman's work. We're represented in this conference by, I would argue, the two best supported treatments for borderline personality disorder. DBT has the most studies across settings and nations showing that it's effective in improving symptoms. However, mentalization-based therapy has 8 years past the beginning of treatment. They did a long treatment. They did 18 months. But they have 8 years past. How do they look? And here we have individuals with mentalization in the pink and treatment as usual in the blue. And we're looking at time here across 8 years. And what we have is this is before treatment. This is at the end of the treatment. This was in a day hospital setting. They were involved with their treatment. At the second assessment, this is 18 months. It's 3 years, the second half of the treatment, large gains in functioning on the mentalization compared to treatment as usual. And what's very striking to me is over time, after they left treatment, getting a focused treatment on borderline personality disorder, they're functioning in terms of, this is specifically looking at employment or school as indicators of functioning, continues to grow, continues once they've had this very focused treatment. We have 70% showing significant functioning in these areas. Marsha Linehan also has data showing a year after her treatment, huge gains in terms of social occupational functioning. What we don't know is, does it have this pattern? Does it continue to rise? I would expect perhaps it does. So I think that's very important to not mistake the earlier non-treatment study with what happens to individuals who actually get the treatment needed. Where does borderline personality disorder come from? There's general consensus that there's some combination of biological and social factors. Heritability is estimated to be about 45%, somewhere in there from different studies, higher than is found in major depression, but considerably lower than schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. There's emerging evidence for genes involved with serotonin and dopamine transmission. So the chemicals, the neurotransmitters in our brain, there seems to be something going on with the genes involved with those. Compromised serotonin functioning is associated with impulsivity. Dopamine dysfunction is associated with emotional dysregulation, impulsivity, and also cognitive perceptual disturbance, things like having issues with confusion and possibly cognitive controls, using our kind of thinking to have an influence on how we emotionally experience something or how we might emotionally react to something. I'll say more about that. Differences in brain structure, there's more studies, imaging studies, where they can actually see what's happening in the brain during the imaging. And so we have studies of brain structure, the size of specific regions, and functioning, what activity occurs in the brain. And there's evidence in the frontal lobal regions, which I'll say more about. I'm not going to label all the areas. But basically, the frontal lobes are involved with controls. In the limbic system, which is deeper in the brain, basically, that's where a lot of our emotional experience occurs, a lot of our emotional reactions. And particularly in terms of structural studies, the hippocampus and the amygdala seem to look different, that there may be a reduced size in individuals with borderline personality disorder. We're basically talking about the amygdala is there. It's actually on both sides, so it's there and there. Hippocampus, there and there. And prefrontal cortex, areas of cognitive control. Those would be areas where there seem to be differences when they look at borderline personality disorder, and particularly when they put them into stressful circumstance, such as thinking about difficult times, exposing them to emotionally charged images, or presenting them with emotionally charged words. That's where you see differences where, such as in this study, where they're comparing individuals with borderline personality disorder and controls, in this instance, they're exposing them to different kinds of words, some emotionally charged and some neutral. The emotionally charged I have here are things like the word enraged, worthless, or abandoned. Or they present them with words like neutral, bookcase, clarinet, rotate. And they give them a task where they have to touch a button or not touch a button, depending on what they see. And this is kind of what kind of control can you do. And what they find is that in the emotionally charged words, there's less activity in the borderline personality disorder. That's what the blue is here. It's comparing these both slides. These are not the two groups. It's where do you see the differences? And these are two different areas we have where there's less activity going on. The non-borderlines, we put our frontal lobes get active, don't hit the button. But it doesn't happen as well when the individual with borderline personality disorder sees the emotionally charged, or hears the emotionally charged word, and then here, or sees the emotionally charged word, and then here the yellow is decreased functioning, and these are areas of the amygdala. So when those emotionally charged words, there's more of an emotional reaction, less cognitive control, poorer functioning in managing behavior in a very simple task. But are these such differences treatable? If we have these brain functions, does that mean this is hopeless? Does that mean, if borderline personality disorder, your brain doesn't work, what can you do? Well, here now there are studies showing, looking at what does treatment do? This is a study, a very small pilot. These are very expensive studies, looking at dialectical behavior therapy. They had six individuals with borderline personality disorder who received dialectical behavior therapy. They compared them with controls who did not. In this particular study, they subdivided four of the individuals by patient assessment and clinician identification were identified as treatment responders. Two of the individuals in that study did not seem to be benefiting at the time that they did the second study. It was only a 12-week study. It was an inpatient DBT study. And of the four, these were examples of pictures that they were exposed to, and then they assessed what was happening in their brain. And what they found is across their days of treatment, these are the four individuals, and this is representing activity in limbic areas, including, in this case, the left amygdala and the hippocampus. And what you see is less activity in those areas exposed, and they controlled. They gave similar but different pictures at each assessment, so they had different pictures of in this case, attacking dogs, different assault pictures. I actually picked the one that was the least evocative. They were all fairly similar. But over time, these individuals, as they learned, in this case, or had treatment through dialectal behavior therapy, there was less of this big reaction in the amygdala and hippocampus, well, in the amygdala. Is BPD a trauma disorder? I did mention that that there's an interaction of social and social and biological. I've talked about the biological. 2 years ago at this program, we actually had our whole focus on issues of trauma and borderline personality disorder, and I'm not going to go in depth. Perry Hoffman mentioned that they do have, National Education Alliance has the largest library of video and audio on borderline personality disorder. There's a tremendous wealth of information. Our conference, the whole thing focused on this. There are strong associations, particularly with early trauma and borderline personality disorder. However, trauma is neither necessary nor sufficient for developing borderline personality disorder. There are individuals who struggle with this, who do not have, there's no evidence of a specific clear trauma. There are definitely many individuals who have very traumatic childhoods who do not develop borderline personality disorder. It actually turns out that resilience is more the rule. And many disorders, you can find high rates of trauma. There is a stronger association with borderline than other disorders, but it's not necessary or sufficient. It seems that there's probably that interaction, something between a biological vulnerability and exposure to trauma that tends to lead specifically to borderline personality disorder versus another disorder. And again, this was discussed in greater length 2 years ago. Please, if you're interested in hearing more, this would be the great excuse to get on that website and see some of those presentations. Relations with other disorders. Individuals with borderline personality disorder, they're typically multi-problem, complex presentations. It's typically not just an individual has borderline personality disorder. Typically, there's major depression, there's substance use disorders, social phobia, PTSD, eating disorders. These are some of the most common comorbid conditions. Also, other personality disorders. It's very rare to have an individual who just has borderline, and this is part of why they're revising the borderline personality disorder and the other personality disorders in Access 2. DSM-5, I have a lot of slides here. I'm actually not going to spend a lot of time with them. I'll try to go quickly through them. Reasons for revising the diagnosis are the excessive comorbidity. That's specifically, if you have borderline personality disorder, you have likely two other personality disorders. So then what does that mean exactly? You don't have three different personalities. You have one problem with your functioning or your adjustment. So that didn't seem to really make a lot of sense. Limited validity for some of the personality disorders. Arbitrary diagnostic thresholds, where's the line between the individual who has or doesn't have borderline personality disorder? It's not a clear line. Instability across time, the diagnosis doesn't hold that well over time, and that was another reason to look at revision. The DSM, the ways to address this, what at this point they're considering in DSM-5 is reducing the number of specific types of personality disorder. Currently there are 10 personality disorders diagnosed. They're looking to reduce it to 5. Borderline would still be included as one of the types. There's a lot of research showing that perhaps giving a narrative description, rather than a list of 9 symptoms, and you've got to meet 5 of those, to give more of a narrative text describing what's an individual with borderline personality disorder like, and then rate that on a scale, how well does this individual match this kind of picture of borderline personality disorder? And then they're also, at this point, talking about adding rating scales of various personality traits, where they can rate from 0 to 4 on how much does a person have each trait, and then the different difficulties of all the personality disorders are represented in those traits. And the hope, I believe, is that every individual would get ratings on all these traits as opposed to just saying, oh, this person has a personality problem and that person doesn't somehow. This is, again, more information about how they're going to diagnose. I'd like to, for time's sake, pass through some of these and encourage you to take a look at the slides. This goes into, for a general personality disorder, they're looking at different areas of functioning self-functioning and interpersonal functioning. This is not just for borderline, but for personality disorder in general. Examples of self-functioning, things like, can the person experience oneself as unique? They have clear boundaries between themselves and other. They have a coherent sense of time and personal history. That if these kinds of problems are there, this wouldn't suggest borderline. This would suggest a personality disorder. Self-direction, the ability to have coherent, meaningful short-term and long-term goals. If someone struggles with that, this would again fall into impairment in self-functioning. And then there's also levels of interpersonal functioning, again, for general personality disorder. The ability to comprehend and appreciate others' experiences and motivations. Tolerance of differing perspectives, understanding of social causality. You'll hear these sorts of themes raised in this conference referring to borderline personality disorder. So again, this is ways that they're talking about representing it as, you can think of it as the, if we think about the description of the difference in functioning and what does that look like across time versus specifically do you meet this borderline criteria. So this seems to be there seems to be an effort to make the social functioning, the self-functioning more prominent. And then for borderline, I'm not going to read this. I have two slides of narrative description. And the idea is that the prototype of borderline personality disorder would have all these things. I'll read the first sentence. Impoverished or unstable self-structure and difficulty maintaining, enduring, and fulfilling intimate relationships. It goes on with a very complete description. It would require clinicians to really read through these well and assess how well does an individual match, and then rate them on their level of match. Another relevant change that's proposed for DSM-5 is actually to include, relevant to this conference, two scales for assessing individuals' risk factors for committing suicide, one for adults and one for adolescents. I think that's very significant, very important. We know that suicide is a particular risk in borderline, but I think this could really be helpful for our cause, for that to be regularly assessed as part of diagnosis. I want to briefly mention some of the challenges for individuals who struggle with borderline personality disorder, their families, and clinicians. I think many of these will be somewhat familiar. For patients, there's certainly a tremendous amount of stigma attached to this diagnosis. There's a lot of research on this demonstrating that clinicians often don't want to work with individuals with borderline personality disorder. They often blame individuals with borderline personality disorder for their difficulties relative to the way that they see individuals with other disorders, such as major depression or psychosis. Finding effective treatment is a huge problem for individuals with borderline personality disorder. It is really difficult. There are not enough clinicians out there who are using empirically supported treatments. Obviously, we've talked about interpersonal functioning impairments. These are individuals who often feel very isolated, often have a lot of desperation around not being able to meet their social needs. Fluctuating levels of functioning. This is really a challenge for an individual who's in recovery from borderline personality disorder, is that often individuals, particularly when they're in an emotionally regulated state, maybe when relationships are smoother, for example, can function at a very high level, but then under stress, functioning can completely fall apart, and that can be very frustrating, can lead to a lot of hopelessness and that difficulty of predicting, can I keep my job because I haven't been able to before because I look great now, but then I fall apart, and then I work, and then I, you know, et cetera. Negative self-concepts and self-loathing, really, really huge challenge for individuals with borderline personality disorder. They see the difficulties that occur in their relationships. The same things that the clinicians often blame them for, the patients, the individuals who try to get treatment, they see the same things that they do, and they tend to blame themselves, I think, even more harshly than the clinicians do. So this is a huge, huge challenge. And then obviously self-destructive behaviors, only knowing ways to get through difficulties through impulsive, self-destructive ways would be another huge challenge. For clinicians, there's a lot of stress involved with treating borderline personality disorder, particularly because of issues such as the high level of risk, which studies have shown repeatedly that the most stressful thing reported by clinicians is having a patient at risk for suicide. And certainly committing suicide is one of the most personally, professionally challenging things that ever occurs to a mental health professional. Self-doubt. It's very frequent working with borderline personality disorder to struggle with. Am I doing this, you know, in a way that is helpful? Even within the empirically supported treatments, you'll hear today, I believe, a little bit about how both of these treatments involve layers of support around that clinician to help them stay on track. Limited access to specialty treatments and training. Clinicians, I would expect that many of you here are hoping to get something that you can use in your own practice, and it's not so easy to go out and get intensively trained. You'll hear about an opportunity, by the way, to get intensively trained in mentalization. There are opportunities to get intensively trained in DBT. They're costly. They take time. It's hard to make it happen, and I understand that. The slow rate of progress working with patients can be very challenging for the clinician. Working in pejorative, hopeless, and adversarial treatment environments, being surrounded by a culture that targets and blames the individual, can make it hard to stay committed to treatment, an effective treatment. DBT doesn't fit the managed care mold. We need more sessions than other treatments, and we run into this time and time again. And managed care companies are more or less educated and open to what the literature shows. There are unfortunately still managed care companies that will say, that's a chronic condition, there's no reason to continue treatment, that's not going to get better. I hadn't run into that in years. I ran into it recently. It was very disturbing to me, and it was very difficult for the individual involved. Studies consistently show that evidence-based treatments are... Studies consistently show that evidence-based treatments are less effective in individuals with borderline personality disorder. Evidence-based treatments for other conditions, for major depression, for PTSD, medication trials, ECT, everything out there, when they look at, well, what about for individuals with borderline personality disorder or other personality disorders, and what you find is that treatment doesn't work as well. It often works. It often does help them get better, but not as much as individuals without borderline personality disorder. This is a really important reason for assessing borderline personality disorder, but it's also a really big frustration, and I think that often leads to a lot of frustration and blame that comes from clinicians when what you do, which you know how to treat people, and it's supposed to work, it doesn't work for this person, and that gets very frustrating and it's challenging. Okay. Family members, stigma and blame, something that's so powerful about the various family programs that I've developed is helping take away some of that blame. It's very easy for family members to blame themselves, and unfortunately, they can get a whole lot of blame from our mental health system for raising an individual with these problems, despite their very best efforts to be the best parents they can be. And that's a huge issue. Invisible. People don't know about borderline personality disorder. And if you've got a family member with this, it can be very hard to explain to people relative to bipolar or depression or schizophrenia. People know, at least have an idea of what that is. A lot of fear around the suicide, self-destructive behavior. Difficulties with the interpersonal functioning. Maintaining a positive relationship with a family member can be very trying and taxing. Difficulty finding providers and effective treatments, again. Isolation. Balancing support and autonomy in your efforts to support the family member to figure out, well, when should I support them and help them? When should I let them stand on their own? Family members really struggle with trying to sort that out, and it is extremely challenging. And a sense of burden, of feeling that this is just so hard to be there, which is really difficult because that's a huge risk factor for the individual with borderline personality disorder when they experience that sense that they're being a burden. I have here, I'm aware of the time, and I want to move toward wrapping up. This is some research showing different areas of burden, of the stress that family members experience, and it really cuts across a large array of areas: emotional health strain, physical health strain, marital stress, social stress, financial stress. There's a lot of difficulty with this. On the other hand, there is very good replicated randomized controlled trials showing that targeted support programs for family members with borderline personality disorder. You'll hear more about the Family Connections Program. There have been repeated randomized controlled trials showing that individuals who go through it have a less experience of burden. Their experience of burden goes way down. Depression goes down. Satisfaction in their relationships goes up. This is very interesting to me because what it's showing, this is not a study of the individual with borderline personality disorder. This is a study of the individual in a relationship with the person with borderline personality disorder, that when those people get the help they need, they don't feel burdened. And if you're a consumer struggling with borderline personality disorder, I hope you can take this to heart, that the issue that it's not about you not being a burden necessarily. It may be about the people supporting you knowing how to take care of themselves in giving you that support, and that would be the thing to do. And if you're worried about that, I would encourage you to encourage your family members to learn about this disorder, and specifically to get involved with programs that are about supporting the family and teaching the family member about how to be an effective support. I want to briefly mention treatment. There was a meta-analysis looking at pharmacology. There is not a medication for borderline personality disorder. However, there have been many studies showing that different medications can help with different kinds of expressions, such as antidepressants and mood stabilizers can be helpful with the effect size. A 0.5 is a moderate effect size, a 1.74 in that first box. That's a really big effect size. So in this instance, it would say that there have been repeated studies, randomized controlled trials, showing that mood stabilizers can really help with the affective, the emotional instability and anger found in borderline personality disorder. So that would actually make sense. Antipsychotics have been shown with a small to moderate effect size in helping with anger and aggression. Antipsychotics help with unstable relationships. There's been studies showing that the relationship issues can get better. And antipsychotics, again, with global functioning. There's been studies showing that can. Nothing in the studies showing the suicidality or leaving studies early has been shown. However, on the bottom there, polypharmacy in BPD is associated with many problems, obesity, many chronic health issues. There's no good research showing what happens. You know, I could look at this and say, oh, so maybe someone should get an antidepressant, a mood stabilizer, and an antipsychotic to get all the benefit. But the research on the individuals who get that show that has some side effects that are concerning. Research support therapies for borderline personality disorder. You're going to hear a lot about two of them. You're going to hear about dialectical behavior therapy and mentalization, but this is the list of studies, manualized studies, that have been published in peer-reviewed journals showing that they help individuals compared to treatment as usual or compared to other treatments in improving functioning in DBT. I also included under this line, these are actually control conditions. These were actually conditions of, here, let me compare my effective treatment to some other systematic approach to treating borderline personality disorder. And those also, although the effects may not have been as strong as these ones above, shown significant gains. We have a mounting amount of evidence showing that if you have a structured approach for addressing the individual with borderline personality disorder, that individuals improve, that they do better. And you can see significant improvements in things such as suicidality, self-harm, substance use, problems of emotions. So it really, the message is there's hope with the treatments, and it is incredibly important for us to get these treatments out there so that people can access them. Just some summaries. I'll end there. We don't have, I don't know if we had questions submitted for this particular talk. What I'm going to suggest is that if you have questions, we're going to have various panels at the end of the day of a group of experts. I would say if you should have questions from my talk, feel free to either approach me on a break or hand those index cards in, and we will incorporate them during the day, and either I or other of our invited experts will respond to questions related to this brief introduction. I would like to introduce our next speaker. Thank you.